This is an interview for the Adelaide University Social History Project of the North Terrace Campus with Professor Fred McDougall and Gary Martin on the 7th of June?
Yes.
2010, interview of Rob Lynn. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for agreeing to be interviewed. I wonder if we could go back in time to the period of the mid to late 80s. And Fred, could we start with you just talking about the beginning of the reformation of the Australian tertiary educational system under John Dawkins and how that came about, if you can think back to
it? Yeah, I suppose I got involved in it in 1987 when I came back here as Professor of Management. And the notion of being able to charge fees for international students, for example, was one of the first things that I came across or had to deal with. It certainly changed our whole approach towards having international students enrolled and certainly changed the nature of some of the programs that we offered, particularly in the professional area. And it did give rise to quite a different culture, because previous to that, students didn't pay fees. Then we had international students who we could charge fees. And the opportunities that created in terms of expansion and being able to hire additional staff was transforming, drove a transformational change in the areas that I was linked with. But mine was a special area, management, MBA, and we were one of the select areas where you could charge fees. But that was the beginning. Thereafter, it expanded and, of course, went into Australian postgraduate coursework students as well, and we rode quite a wave of expansion in the early 90s in terms of student numbers, in terms of the economics of our operations and the ability to bring a lot of new staff on board, and so it was an exciting time to be at this university and indeed at other universities in those same areas. But like all things, the good times didn't last beyond the mid 90s. Universities started to wake up the fact that they could tax these funds, and what we essentially was receiving was university funding plus fee income. University woke up that we were double dipping and then started to say, well, you'll receive no more university support in respect to those students. So it became a case of replacing one source of funding with another. And we sort of slid back to where we were when we started in the 1990s. But it had an effect. It had changed our whole view to expansion and the economics of growth. And I think our ability to grow our program provided an example to other parts of the university that had been static, been inward-looking, that they could grow as well, and that there were other sources of students that could provide funding, bring about transformational change, because suddenly you had access to funding that you wouldn't have in a normal course.
Yeah, thanks, Fred. Gary, what are your memories of this era and the changes that have occurred after?
Yeah, I do think it was a really significant watershed in the history of the sector. Universities and the sector have been fairly small, fairly elite. We tended to mind our own business and that sort of thing. When Dawkins brought out his green paper, followed by the white paper that caused all the fuss, I mean, one of the things that they were really pushing was university accountability. They were looking at universities needing to sort of plan better, to be more effective in managing their resources. And I think that significantly changed our outlook. So our first strategic plan came out shortly after that period. And for the first time, I think we started looking at sort of forward development cycles rather than just kind of replicating an administrative cycle, which I think is probably largely the way people behaved prior to that. We realised that we were moving into a sort of period of mass education, and all sorts of things led to that, or paved the way for it, I guess. The first sort of equity push came out in late 80s, around 89, 90, with the release of the Fair Chance for All policy paper, which was the sort of precursor of the current batch of reforms. Of course, the HECS was introduced. As Fred said, some fees were starting to be introduced. So you often look back at the Dawkins period and think of it as a kind of almost sort of Stalinist planned economy stuff. But in fact, the seeds of a lot of the deregulative stages that have occurred since were sown in at that time. And so I don't think we would have got to the stage where we have without some of those initial sort of foundation changes. So I think, you know, once you, as an institution and a big and a necessarily growing one, particularly following mergers and things, once you're in a regime where you have to look forward and plan, you take an entirely different view of managing your business, I think. And just my own memories of being sort of an administrator, I mean, as I said earlier, we used to, I think the feeling was that you administered an organisation, that is, you replicated what happened the year before and they happened the year before on a regular continuous cycle, but we went into a phase where we managed them, and I think there's a fundamental difference in outlook implied there, that you're actually looking at development opportunities. That was the period when we first bought property over the road. It was the period when we first started looking at an offshore campus. We even started looking seriously at management information systems for the first time. We had student system, but nothing much. I mean, all sorts of things arose out of the sort of change in paradigm that came about as a result of the Dawkins reforms, I think. So they might not have been directly related to some of the things that you're talking about, but they certainly provided a different sort of, you know, cultural landscape, you might say.
We were talking earlier too about the attitudes of the then Vice Chancellor, Kevin Marjoribanks. Do you, either of you, have any memories of the response from the hierarchy here towards the Dawkins reports?
Do you want to go first, Doug?
Yeah, well, Kevin was very, very visible and very sort of vociferous in his opposition initially to the to what was being proposed. I think there was a lot that was seen as infringement of academic freedom and those sorts of issues. But I think as time went on and we began looking at more practical considerations such as mergers and frankly what you can get out of the process, I think probably we swung around to a more sort of pragmatic perspective and saw that there was a different kind of role we could play. So there was a change over time, but certainly the initial reactions were sort of end of civilization stuff, really, that this is this is the end of the world as we know it. We can't abide this.
I mean, I can recall Kevin talking at Academic Board on a number of occasions, adamantly opposed to the Dawkins reforms, and very surprised when it suddenly turned around and the announcement was that the university was merging with Roseworthy and the Adelaide College. In fact, astounded that without any warning, at least from an academic perspective, we were suddenly in serious discussions in terms of the moment.
Yeah, there were a lot of other players around in those days, weren't there, Fred, with the executive committee structure that we had. So there were people like Brian Abbey and Ian Davey and, of course, Frank O'Neill, who I think probably took a more practical line about the sorts of advantages that we could probably gain from...
Actually, you just raised something in my mind. Would Ian Davey, for instance, who then moved on to UniSA in later years, would he have taken a more pragmatic line like Frank?
Yes.
Yeah, he was a pragmatic person.
Yeah, very much so. He was, I think, executive member for research at that stage, wasn't he? And then became... what was it, Dean of Graduate Studies in the new structure after the Review of Governance. The Review of Governance that we had here that actually changed our model from a collegial one that probably suited the previous era to a more executive model, a variation of which we probably still have now.
I was on that working group.
That's right, yeah.
So you were talking about the report here.
Peter Carmel, wasn't it?
Peter Carmel was the chair.
Well, that was funded directly out of funds associated with the post-Dawkins transformation. Yeah. So we used that money...
Hugh Stretton and I,
that's right.
Who else was there?
David Israel was the secretary.
David Israel, and I'm trying to think who the other guy was. Harry Medlin.
Oh, Harry.
Harry, that's right. Harry was on it, yeah.
Were the members of that group. I think there was someone else from council, I can't recall who that was. So we looked at the structure of it, and I must say it was largely driven... By Peter Carmel. He was really he had his mind made up as to the type of structure that universities should have, and it was fairly well removed from what the University of Adelaide had. It was certainly a much more top-down management style than had been in place here, which is pretty much a bottom-up management structure.
I've heard the previous structure described slightly disparagingly by someone as the worker-controlled factory. This was a right-wing economy, so you can imagine his perspective on that.
I was sort of somewhat amazed at Hugh Stretton and Harry Medlin. Harry Medlin, who had been the first chair of the executive committee and was really wedded to that type of model, and Hugh Stretton, who sided with Peter Carmel. Hugh Stretton sort of saying, well, the current system wasn't working, therefore we ought to try something else. And I was amazed because my understanding was that Hugh was there sort of representing, if you like, him being on there gave a degree of comfort to the, the academic community, knowing he had strong views, and those views are very academic, and you know, academics should make decisions and that. But Harry sort of always saying, you know, no, the university must be run by the academics, and there ought not to be a professional management elite making decisions on behalf of the academic community. But even Harry, towards the end, came around to, he was aware of the fact that the executive committee, as it existed under him, was not the same structure as currently was in place, and that academics had abdicated their right to lead by just simply not making decisions. The whole thing had become, I don't know what you'd call it, it entered into a period of stalemate in decision making.
Convoluted processes.
It would take so long for decisions to be made, and often they would go round and round in the system. And Harry was aware that the strong sort of focus on quick decision making, albeit with proper consideration, had broken down over successive chairs of that executive committee, that change was needed.
Would it be correct to say, looking back even further, that from the early 70s, that the professorial rule by professor model here had gone in favour of the academic working model, which at this time, pre and then into Dawkins, was really... Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was, there were two levels of it, I suppose. There was the central management of the institution, but there was also the management of departments. And we'd move from the old sort of professorial head model into a departmental, I think they just called it departmental management. And it was a form of sort of departmental democracy, I suppose. It was a very Athenian form of democracy, because I think sort of women foreigners and others didn't get the vote. You had to be a sort of tenured academic to get the vote. That's the historian coming out there. So that occurred at the departmental level, and at the institutional level was this executive committee thing. So there was the what was then called the education committee, a bit like our academic board. That had an executive committee that met every week, and then it had a series of subcommittees which also met every week, and a volume of paper went up like this. I just indicated 4 inches thick. up and down. The celebrated case of the dead tree, the diseased tree, that that the Grounds, Buildings and Accommodation Committee had to make a recommendation to pull out because that was an academic decision. You couldn't just rip out a dead tree without everyone taking it. And it went up and down this thing for a bit. It took about 9 months to rip out this tree. It's lucky it didn't bloody kill anyone in the meantime. That was the cause célèbre, I think. So that was the first transition. It was professorial heads into departmental governance, then the Corbett report slapped the executive
I did get the impression that Kevin wasn't happy with this group being established. It was as if he'd been talked into it. And I remember the then Chancellor, she came along and told us that we could do anything that we, you know, she'd be happy to accept recommendations, but we were not to touch the council. We were the moment we went near the council, that would be the end of it. Right. So we were restricted in terms of what we could do, because some of the problems people said were at the council level as well, because, you know, it was a continuum between the senior management and into the governing body. But she drew a line and said the working party could only deal with the management of the university. It couldn't deal with the governance of the university.
Well, that's in hindsight quite a pity.
Yeah.
But it must have made for a fascinating time for people like you who were both in and looking on.
Yeah.
I hadn't been here all that long again, and I'd had interaction with the executive committee. I actually found it quite refreshing sometimes, because certainly the people I dealt with earlier on when I came back here in 87, 88 were very supportive, and I could get quick decisions. But I did get a sense as we went into the 90s that it really did slow down, and I think it was a issue of the people who were appointed to the to head those key positions subsequently. And as I said, I think mm-hmm. Harry acknowledged that the system had was glued mm-hmm. and that it needed to be unstuck. And so he supported the working party by virtue that he knew the university needed it. So mm-hmm. even though he really had a strong commitment to the executive committee model, he was prepared to look at other models.
Yeah, which I think is his character too.
Yeah, absolutely. And whilst he certainly didn't agree with everything, and he was sometimes the only person not supporting a particular issue, he was prepared to give the major recommendations a go. But Peter Carmel, he just drove it. And I often got the feeling that between he and Frank and David Israel, they'd sorted out before they come along to the working party, and he just spent most of the time bullying us into agreeing with
very
what he was
well
proposing.
Yeah, I can't possibly comment. Not while certain people remain alive.
No.
So this is, in, as I was saying to you earlier, that there's a view that I have as an outsider looking in, that there's a hiatus of action on this campus for nearly three decades, in a sense, of at least physical building action here, until I think probably the demolition of the Fisher Building is one of the first signs of action.
Well, there was the lower level
development
building, the biosciences building.
But the Fisher was wrecked as a result of that.
Was that before that or after that? I can't remember.
That went up.
Yeah. So that was that mid-90s?
No, it was, well, it was in the...
Like 96?
Would have been 96 because it was when Mary O'Kane...
Because
that was the first time we went in to borrow substantial sums of money.
That's right.
Because prior to that, I think the purchases across the road were from bequest money.
Yeah.
Tenpolder
Street was borrowed, but the purchase of 233 North Terrace...
It's Elizabeth
House. No, Security House.
Oh, Security House, yeah.
Was purchased... I think 1991 or two. Actually, even earlier, might have been late 80s, because we moved in there as
late,
the first group, and I think we moved in there about 89, 90.
Okay.
So it must have been purchased in 88.
Yeah.
And I was on the facilities committee when we purchased the land on the old Gerard Goodman warehouse,
yes,
and the land where the car park now stands on Frome Street, and also the Wilson's car park site.
Yeah.
So there were, I think, three separate pieces of land. Subsequently, they bought the Urban Cow building, two buildings that are north of the car park entrance on Frome Street.
Mm.
You know, besides the Christian Science Church, beside the Christian Science.
You've got to remember, Rob, in the 80s we had less than 10,000 students.
Yes, this is
now, and now we've got nearly 20,000. So, whilst there was probably a need for more effective systematic refurbishment, there probably wasn't a great need for entirely new buildings at that point. And it's only as we started to move into this development phase that the delayed, I guess, need for buildings as a result of initiatives that were started some years before started to come to fruition. So we did, as Fred says, start going off campus, and then that biosciences building was the first major development what would have been the previous building to that?
The
Union Building.
Union Building.
72?
Yeah.
And the plaza in the 1960s.
There wouldn't have been much, but I guess, you know, in terms of just raw building stock, we probably didn't need too much more. I mean, we've only just started to absorb the capacity that we've had today.
So the reason for a lot of what we've been talking about was the initial question about the Dawkins papers. And it appears from what you're saying that they were the impetus to this period of growth and change.
Fundamental organisational change and sectoral change. I think the whole position of universities, and this one in particular, changed during that period. And I think what we're seeing now is a direct lineal outcome of those initial steps.
Well, since that time and Marchbank's retirement, there's been another four vice-chancellors since then?
Gavin Brown, Mary O'Kane, Cliff Blake briefly, and then James McMahon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's been four.
Mm. Yeah.
What's been the change over that period of those four vice-chancellors? Up until the present, it seems that particularly in terms of the built form here on this campus, the last 7 or 8 years have seen a very different approach to the previous decade, at least, in terms of consolidation.
I think the issue with the lower level development is that, first time I think the university had borrowed substantial sums of money to undertake a major development. And I think it took a few years to digest that.
We did actually use a lot of our available capital in that period, didn't we? With that and some fairly hefty systems developments.
Development. Mm. With the introduction of the PeopleSoft system, where we had a substantial cost overrun there. And of course, the end result of that was that after having been sort of making reasonable, consistent surpluses, or at least at best break even, the university suddenly went into a loss situation, and that caught up with Mary O'Kane. And I think it took a combination of Cliff Blake and the first few years of our current Vice Chancellor, James McCaw, to get past that system through both a significant restructuring of the university. What major redundancies in 2001, with about 120, 130 redundancies, particularly in the sciences. The restructuring of the faculties that had started earlier on under Gavin Brown and then resumed a bit under Cliff Blake and then into James's period. And really, it was only after that restructuring and using growth in student numbers as a way of lifting the university out of its financial situation, particularly an aggressive push into attracting full fee paying international students and taking advantage of changes in regulation, enabled us to recruit full fee paying Australian students. That we started to generate substantial surpluses that then could be started to be used for a renewed building program.
Yeah, so there was some fairly significant debate amongst the sort of central executive and the deans and others back in James's early period about what sort of best strategy to adopt, I suppose, to respond to those difficult situations. And I think the right decision at the time was to actually achieve an economy of scale through student numbers growth. We analysed, and I think we were right at the time, that we couldn't possibly sustain the amount of research intensity and the breadth of disciplines that we had with the student base, the way that funding and other things worked at that time. And again, that was an outcome probably of what had been going before and thrust us even more into the international student market. And we've had very steady growth in student numbers of all categories pretty much since that date. We had a fairly hefty, it's not just about new buildings, I think just maintenance of existing buildings had probably fallen behind, and we've had to plough a considerable amount of the money we've been able to generate back into getting existing buildings back on the road to being up to scratch and refurbishing lecture theatres and modernising them, stuff like this and other things, you know. So,
and I think also entering into leasing too. We now lease a hell of a lot of buildings around the city. Mm. And so it was really a two-pronged strategy, or three-pronged strategy, lifting the current buildings up to reasonable standard, leasing buildings rather than, because we just didn't have the capital to meet the growth and demand, so we leased buildings increasingly around North Terrace. And up into Grenfell Street, but also in other parts of the city, and thirdly, looking at new build.
Yeah, I guess, while Fred was saying, I was just thinking, there are three things that we've done in the period that relate to use of space in the campus site, I suppose, not necessarily buildings, that sort of exemplify the change that's been necessary. From one of being, I'm talking about the sector here, being relatively insular and self-absorbed, you might say, to being more effectively engaged. And the first is, the rental properties, whilst that's driven by necessity, it's actually getting us into the city and being visible. The second one is the way that the North Terrace precinct has been completely refurbished harmoniously with the external North Terrace redevelopment. And at the same time, the walls have come down and it's opened the campus up, and there are clear lines of sight through and thoroughfares. Again, that's about engagement and opening us up, and we're very conscious and deliberate about that. And the third one is signage. You couldn't find your way around it. It was a very discreet organisation. You had to know someone or knew someone that knew someone in order to find your way around. And now we've got very visible signage. It might not be everyone's cup of tea, but I actually think it's a massive step forward. It's about, again, opening the place up and allowing people in and through and to know where they're going and to know where they are. And so those three sort of property-related issues, I think, quite exemplify some of the other changes that have been occurring.
Gary, you got to exactly where I was hoping to lead you both to.
No, right.
Is that part of the premise of the manuscript up to this point is that over time the community and the university had a very unusual relationship. The wider South Australian community felt a sense of ownership on one level, but there was a distance too between the majority of the community and the university. And the question I was going to ask was, those very changes you've described seem to have had a physical effect on bringing the city into the university and vice versa.
During the 2001, 2002, 2003, there was a different approach to planning this North Terrace campus. We started to get campus-wide plans being done by a number of consultants. So it got us to think more whole of campus rather than the lower level or the upper level or over on Kintore Avenue or whatever it might be.
Mm.
And I think some of the issues that Gary raised started to be addressed by those consultants and got us thinking in a different way than we had been thinking previously.
Mm.
And to the extent that we're not only done on the North Terrace front, but we're now talking about the Victoria Drive opening up on the riverside to try and achieve the same benefits. Exactly. it's a matter of priorities, but it's certainly on our plans to do something.
Yeah.
Just as we're sort of trying to get that feeling of integration on the old mass lawn going through to the extension of the Botanical Gardens, that vista you can now see.
Yeah.
Although people tell me that it was part of the bequest of the Bar Smith family that you could always see the Bar Smith Library from Road.
Yeah, this is where your good wife Fred and I agree that this vision of Walter Baggett with the long vista was very much there from the beginning.
Yes. Yeah.
And I did notice when I told the Vice Chancellor that Kintore Avenue had been blocked off for many years into Victoria Drive, that he showed great interest
in. With the Fisher Building. Yeah.
Yes. Kintore Avenue.
Yeah, oh, Kintore Avenue.
At the barracks.
Yeah.
You should never seed ideas like that.
No, that's what Paul Golding said.
Well, we have been talking to unofficially the City Council, I think, for some time to close Victoria Drive so that we could, basically go right down to the river banks and just give us that bit more room down that end of it. And it's certainly Martin Evans has been one of his projects to try and achieve that, but I think there's the chance of that happening is pretty slim.
Long way off the moment.
Now, just a final question for you both in terms of where we've come from in looking at the Dawkins reports and papers and the effect on the university. What of the immediate future? Where do you see that going in terms of a site like the North Terrace campus?
Well, you want to do it from a planning perspective because you're heavily involved in some of these issues at the moment in terms of capacity, etc.
We've really got to get a final understanding of what the capacity of the campus is.
Mm.
And I mean that at a fairly fine-grained level. We're probably getting closer to macro level, but some areas are more crowded than others. We've got to understand that a bit better. But I mean, we've also got to take into account whether a university day is 9 to 5 or whether it's 24/7 and 365 days a year, and maybe we need to start thinking more broadly than just the North Terrace campus. So there's a lot of issues we've got to start to think through, but it's all contingent really on, I guess, population density and availability of capital to serve it. And there were some glimmers that there'd be a bit more capital available a couple of years ago from the Commonwealth sources, but they're post GFC sort of drying up somewhat. So our options are probably a little better than they might have been 4 or 5 years ago, but nowhere near as good as we were sort of hoping. So I think we've still got a stage to go forward, but I suspect that the period of rapid growth is coming to its end. There will be consolidation. There might be targeted growth in certain key areas. I would like to take a stab at what they might be just at the moment. I should tell your listeners before I tell the people here.
I think the issue about the student experience as well. I mean, we've got this building stock, largely inherited from the first part of the last century, which are really not appropriate for the type of teaching activity, learning activity, which increasingly we're involved in. A bit more like group work, students working in teams, team learning, using electronic means of delivering material, debating discussion space. We're really short on that. A lot of the old buildings like the Benham and the Mawson and even the physics building don't have student space in them. They were built largely for staff, with a lecture theatre added on the back, and students were really sometimes not even permitted to go into the building or in certain parts of the building. That was the reserve of staff. So we've got all these buildings that we've inherited, and if even you take your old building, there's no student space in that as such. No social space.
Quite true.
And so...
it was never social space anyway.
No, that's exactly right. And so, what we're trying to do with a new engineering building is to build in social space on the ground floor and flowing out naturally into the lawn space with a cafe located right next to where we expect the students to be. And the building of Student Hub is an attempt to try and address that in a major sense, which we've already done across in 10 Pulteney Street to some extent. So we've got a real challenge in trying to adapt our building stock meet the student expectations of the way that they want to learn and the way technology enables them to learn. And there's a big gap between where we need to be and where we currently are, which will be a real challenge for the university to address in the next, and looking forward.
Anything else, Gary?
I think that's the really critical point. It's about moving from, I guess, a teaching-driven environment to a learning-driven environment. Yeah. I mean, it's all very postmodern, but... that's really going to shape our sort of design and spatial usage in the future.
Well, thank you both so very much for being willing to contribute to this. It's excellent.
Oh, no, good luck with it. You must be getting near the end of it now, are you?